Hey, it's Jeff here. After working as an automotive tech for almost 25 years, I can honestly say that finding employment with the right shop has been the difference maker between loving what I do every day or hating my career choice. Let me tell you, I've been there, but I've also had jobs where work didn't really feel like work. I love the challenge of fixing cars, so loving what I do, that's the easy part. Finding a good place to do it in, now that's been the struggle. And that's where my friends at ProMotive knock it out of the park. They're a recruitment company specializing in jobs for our automotive industry. A-techs, B-techs, master techs, service advisors, managers, you name it. They are constantly looking for applicants in automotive to link them with available job postings at only the best vested shops around the country. ProMotive has a team of professional recruiters that can help you with your resume, prep you for the interview process, and negotiate the best pay and benefits package for you. And best of all, it's free to anyone looking to gain employment. Check them out at gopromotive.com/Jeff. gopromotive.com/Jeff. Just think, you could be just 5 minutes away from finding your dream job.
You know, I became a pretty good practical joker. If you work a mechanic, work in a dealership, you're going to become a pretty good practical joker.
That's Chris Rainville, our guest this week on the Jaded Mechanic Podcast. This is part two of a lengthy conversation between Jeff and Chris. If you want to hear part one, be sure to listen to last week's episode. But now, back to the conversation.
Yeah, it's... I've heard... I was listening to another a YouTube video this morning, and somebody was talking about how when they were coming up, they tend to be hazed. You know what I mean? Did you go through that?
I don't feel I did.
Yeah.
I just felt like, a few of the older guys just, they really didn't want to help you. They'd help you if they had to, but no, I didn't feel like I was hazed. I'm sure they laughed at me because, I was young and green, but no. And I don't feel like any younger techs that came in, I felt like I hazed them. I didn't feel the job stressful enough. You don't need to add to it. I actually felt bad for younger guys that would come in knowing what they were going to have to learn and deal with and go through. Mm-hmm. So I felt like, I didn't want to add to the stress of it,
Yeah. I can think back to some of the nicknames that I was given early on in my career. And a lot of them are not very flattering, right? And, it's so different now. I mean, like, I have a young person I work with, and I nicknamed him Jethro.
Yeah.
And he has no idea what that means. And it's just like, I mean, his name is Zach, but I call him Jethro.
It's probably just as well.
Yeah. And it's like, he's a great kid. He's learning, he's doing fine. And, but like, they look at it and they kind of give you that look, like when you don't call them by your name. And I'm thinking, I can't even repeat on the air what I got was referred to for, like, by the boss, not just the other, like, that became, you might as well have had that engraved on my shirt. That was my name. It wasn't very flattering. I'm not going to repeat it. And then I had a boss that, like, he was, so before the dealership, when I worked at that little shop, everything that you ever did wrong, like your biggest screw up. Now, you got me thinking before we came on the air here. Early on, we were doing tie rod ends, inners on an old Intrepid. So that's the style where the bolts up to the rack. Now,
those suck.
Yes, they do. Yeah. And my boss, so we're talking like 2001.
Yeah.
You could still somehow, instead of buying the whole damn tie rod, buy the bushing and then try to fart around pressing it into the tie rod. So my boss, in all his infinite wisdom, instead of buying it the way we, as soon as I went to work at the dealers, we did is you got, the inner tie rod, you got the little sleeve, you got your outer tie rod, and that's how you changed it. We went through the whole headache of taking it out of the car to try and piss around with pressing this little $8 bushing in, which it didn't sit in because it was obviously a really cheap aftermarket part that was never going to fit into this rod. So then we finally have to scramble around. We find two inner tie rods to put in this car. We get it put in the car and we go over to the alignment rack. which the alignment machine didn't really work that well. I think it was one of the last alignments we did on it. And he's like, okay, so, you know, and that one, when you're trying to heat up that sleeve to adjust the tie rod, because of course we reused the sleeve, we reused the, you know, outer tie rod. We didn't clean anything before we put it together. Well, of course we had to get it hot in there. And I caught part of the wiring harness on fire because the conduit just, like, you've got the torch right there heating up the yeah. sleeve and caught the conduit on fire. And by the time I could get over the scrap of scrap metal that was piled up in front of the fire extinguisher to hit it with it, we'd burned quite a few of the wires. Enough wires that it took my coworker, my mentor, the next day to piece that harness back together, one wire at a time, with like pieces of scrap wire they had. So when you're asking me, that was one of my bigger screw ups. But my nickname now for him, if he was to see me tomorrow, is he calls me Flame-O.
I don't think that's that bad.
No, it's not that bad. Yeah. But I mean, it's just like the fact that, like, I saw him. So I saw him 3 years ago. It had been 20 years. I called him up and I said, hey, you know, how are you doing? Flame-O? And I'm like, you jerk of an old man, you. How are you doing? Right? Like, it's just so when I see the young kids now, they're really, it's a different world, right? Like, you know, I mean, I didn't get fired for that screw up. Yeah. You know, I learned a lesson. Move on.
Yeah. I don't even think that's that bad of a screw up. I've caught stuff on fire. It's going to happen because if you live in a rust belt, you're using a torch a lot. You're going to catch things on fire. It just happens. And you learn, you just learn from it, you know?
Yeah.
You know, you say Intrepid. I remember doing alignment on those, and I remember they're really difficult to line up because to reach the tie rod ends, they're up above the tire.
Yeah.
And it's almost impossible to line those things up.
Yeah.
And if you had a jam nut that was seized and had to heat it up. So, I mean, it happens, you know?
Yeah.
That's, to me, that's not a bad screw up. I've had a lot worse than that. and, you know, but I look back over 30 years, I prepared a lot more vehicles, you know, that come out good than I screwed up. And as long as you just learn from your mistakes, you know, anybody that says they've worked any years as a tech and hasn't made any mistakes, then they're a liar.
Yeah. 1000%. I liken it back to, I mean, Paul Danner, you know, is my hero because I mean, he shows us what, like he had a Jeep burn down. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like he had all the airbags go off on that in Suburban. Like, you know, one of the sharpest guys in the industry, bar none. You know, we all sometimes just have little slip ups that we're not thinking, we're rushing, we're doing something happens. You know, that's life. You know,
you're trying to beat the clock. You're not only trying to get the job right, you're trying to beat the clock, right? Yeah. You got appointments behind you, people waiting. It's stressful, and sometimes it's hard to handle the stress on a day to day basis. You know,
I was working at Hyundai. I was there less than a month, and I've told the story before. I caught it on fire because they sold an injection flush on it for a misfire. I didn't sell it; somebody else did. I was tasked with doing it, and I'm driving it into the bay, and I'm hearing this snapping under the hood. And I'm like, this is probably not going to fix it. But of course, I pulled the fuel line off. Like I pulled the relay out, let the thing run down, right. Get the rail purged, take the line off, spill a little bit of fuel. Thought I wiped it up. Hook my fuel injector machine up to it, right? Turn the key. Whoosh, last little bit of gas and the stray ignition wire that was the cause of the misfire all the time caught fire. And then I had to like grab the fire extinguisher and like spray right into the air box, right? You know, to like, so. I mean, anybody that says I make that joke all the time, if you're working in this trade long enough, you are going to set cars on fire. It's just going to happen. You know,
especially if you live in the Rust Belt.
Yeah.
Because you're always using the torches. You can't do front end work without a acetylene torch.
I don't even wheel it over to do an alignment anymore without taking it with me because the jam nuts are always seized. Always.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, what I do usually is if I get a vehicle coming for alignment, I bring it on my regular two-post lift, check the front end out, and if it's rusty, I get the torches right out then and heat up the GM nuts, loosen them up, and make sure the tie rods are adjustable even before I put it on the rack.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just saves time, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, speaking of fire, I had the same kind of situation as you did. Early when I started the dealership and I was just doing front end work and alignments, I had changed the gas tank on a, I think it was a, I don't even remember now, Chevy car. Anyways, you know, rear wheel drive, Caprice, Chevy Caprice. Yeah. Remember those?
Yeah.
Rear wheel drive. So I changed the fuel tank in it. And of course, gas, you know, went all over the place on the alignment rack. And you know, on the alignment rack, you got the tracks, the valleys where the jacks slide on.
Yeah.
Well, apparently some gas went down those tracks. So of course, my next job is an exhaust job, right? Oh. Where I got to cut the exhaust out. So I just remember, you know, I was cutting exhaust, and next thing I look, my buddy Albie is behind me with a fire extinguisher putting out the alignment rack. Both tracks had a lot of fire going down both ways of the alignment rack. Never even knew they were on fire, only because he was putting them out with the. So I just kept working, you know. Oh, he's got that under control. I just kept cutting the exhaust off. You know,
I worked in a shop that was known for doing leaf springs, local here in town, and they brought in more than one old Chevy truck with like to do leaf springs in the back or add a leaf, whatever we wanted to do, whatever we had to do. And like, if anyone's ever done that, you don't even bother to take the U-bolts off the leaf shackles, right? You just cut them off with a torch. And we had more than one that came in. It was like, hey, it's a Chevy truck. The tank is like, I can smell gas under here. Oh, look, there's a fuel line that's, you know, a little perforated. I don't think we should do this job. They'd be like, nope, get under there and do it. So we literally like, and it was in a pit. We always worked in a pit, and the jacks, it was the fastest way to do springs I've ever done in my life. I could do two springs so fast in a Chevy truck or Ford. Didn't really matter. Make your head spin. It was quick. And we just got to where you're down in the pit. You take two fire extinguishers down with you and your torch.
Yeah.
And if it was a leaker, because they weren't going to turn the job away. And, you know, you couldn't make the guy, because like a lot of that stuff was like, well, listen, this thing isn't safe with the fuel line. He's like, listen, I only use it to haul wood, so I'm not fixing a fuel leak. I just need these leaves because, like, you know, the thing's bottoming out. Okay, right? Like, it just, you know, I mean, and what are you going to do? You going to tell the customer no? Like, you really should.
Yeah.
But so many of us work for people that won't do that.
Right.
So I've been lucky. I've never burnt one down. I've never burnt one to the point of where you couldn't fix it. So
yeah, I haven't burnt one down yet. So hopefully I keep the streak going.
Yeah.
You know, early, see, I'm probably what, 53 now. I think back when I was in my maybe late 20s, you know, it was a few years after I'd been to the dealership, I had a major screw up that scared the hell out of me. Of course, it's, you know, last job on a Friday. You want to be out of there at 5 o'clock, you know. And I was working on a dually Chevy, you know, one ton pickup.
Yeah.
I think I was doing axle seals. And I was waiting. I was trying to get it back together, you know, get ahead of the game. I was waiting on a rear end cover gasket. Mm-hmm. And I was waiting for parts to get that to me. So I was trying to get ahead of the game. So, of course, you know, the axle seals are all changed. So trying to get ahead of the game, I put the axles back in. And I put the horse collar clips back in.
Yep.
But I didn't put the center pin in. Instead, I put the tires on.
Right.
Right? I threw the tires on.
Yeah.
And then finally the gasket shows up. So I put the center pin in, put it all together, and I go to road test it. And I'm going down the road, and I get to like a four-way. Like, you know, you got traffic going, you know. Well, no, it's a three-way. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Three directions, and it's right near the IGA store. I go to turn in. I happen to look out my rear view mirror, and I can see the wheel sticking out like 3 feet. The axle's coming out of the rear end.
Wow.
So when I threw the tires on, it pushed the horse clip out. It dropped in on the rear end.
Yeah.
and the axle was never in. And yeah. I stop and I'm like, oh my God, what do I do?
Yep.
Yeah. And I thought I ruined the rear end, mm-hmm. you know, at this point. And thank God my buddy who was service writer at the time, Steve, was on his way home and he stops and he's pointing and laughing at me, you know, but he turns around, takes off. He goes, I'll go get the wrecker. You know, he took off, went back, and it's only like 5 minutes down the road, you know, but it's in a bad place. I can't move, you know, and I'm blocking traffic in three ways. Mm-hmm. So if it isn't embarrassing enough, everybody's like, what the hell is this idiot doing? You know?
Yeah.
And my buddy Steve comes down with a wrecker, hooks onto it, gets me back into the shop. And of course, the customer's waiting, you know. And I'm thinking I ruined the rear end in this truck, you know. Yeah. And so I put it back on the lift. I pulled the cover off. And, you know, the horseshoe clip dropped at the bottom of the rear end. It didn't go in. Nothing got damaged. I couldn't believe it, you know. Yeah. So, I put the axles back in, put the clips back in, fill it back up with oil. Everything's good. I road test it. Everything's good. And the customer only ends up waiting, you know, like maybe 15, 20 minutes later. Yeah. So he doesn't even know anything went wrong.
Right.
You know, for me, I'm thinking I just ruined this guy's rear end, you know, and I'm going to get fired or whatever. I was trying to rush, trying to get it done. And I just, luckily I had a good coworker looking out for me and I just got a little bit lucky. But that was a good learning lesson that, you just don't do things in certain order, no matter, you can't rush certain things, you know?
That's why, like, I was just having a conversation before you and I got on and we got talking. It was another guy, a future upcoming guest, Rich is his name, talking about how it used to drive him nuts. You'd be in the middle of doing an intake job or something like that, and then somebody pull you to do an oil change, you know? And we talk about that in the groups all the time about how that's, like, so hard to get the tech just back into an efficient mode, right? Yeah. Because you've broken that train of thought to go in there. But that's where I honestly believe when we talk about techs that forgot to do this, or, you know, they did a big engine job and this happened after the fact. I honestly believe that's where most of that comes from, is because we pull them off to go scan that or go road test that with that customer or something like that. And then you come back to it and it's like, what happened? I forget. Or it's like, oh, he dropped something down the engine. I'm not so naive as to think there aren't people out there that some, I think, work in some places where people sabotage you.
Yeah.
Right. I've seen shops with enough toxic culture that, like, they wouldn't think of not doing that.
That happens a lot at the dealer, and it happens to me. They try not to do it. They've kind of learned that it's inefficient to do that to us, but it does happen. But over the years, what I've learned is if I'm in the middle of doing an engine job, pulling heads, you know, doing lifters or whatever, I finish what I'm doing. So if that waiter is going to wait another 10 minutes for me to finish torquing that bolts, I finish what I'm going to do before I switch over to it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to make a mistake because I get pulled off. Because you're right. It can screw you up. But I feel as a tech, it's my responsibility that if I'm going to get pulled off the job, leave it in a point where I don't screw it up. Mm-hmm. To me, that's my responsibility.
Yeah.
You know? But you're right. I mean, it sucks if you're in the middle of a big engine job, or what's even worse, if you're doing an electrical diagnosis, so you're trying to, chase down a short and you get pulled off, you lose your train of thought. You know, you're looking at the wiring diagram, looking at the circuit, trying to break it down, and then, I need this tire fixed. It's like, really? You know? Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's the way the industry is, you know?
Yeah. When you and I first started to talk tonight, we kind of got talking about pay. And you said you'd gotten a pretty good pay bump recently.
Yeah.
Without even having to ask for it. And that's the first time that ever happened.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes it feel pretty good, eh?
Yeah. I mean, I think if I remember right, I think it was like over $5 an hour. To me, that's a pretty big pay raise.
That is a good bump. Yeah.
And it's a big change to what, you know, early in my career, I was always felt like I was underpaid, you know, and to a certain point, I don't think I'm paid what we should be paid. But I remember in my 20s and 30s, when I was working the dealership, pulling transmissions, pulling engines, and getting paid $10 an hour, it didn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
No.
You know, And I got to the point, and I look back at it now, and I think maybe the dealership wasn't doing as well as I thought it was, even though we were busy as hell, you know, putting out work. I mean, we're never not had work, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of nights I remember nights I worked, you know, we get behind on our sales work, you know, sales cars, because we're so busy with customer paid that I remember a few nights they would ask me to work late and be there 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say no because it was easy money.
Yeah.
You know, doing a used vehicle inspection, doing brakes. That was, you know, when you were making 10 bucks an hour, you get those extra hours, boy, it bumped up your pay.
Yeah.
You know? And, I remember working for years, you know, $8, $9, $10 an hour. And it's like, you know, here I am doing all this training, buying all these tools.
Yeah.
And I'm still making $10 an hour. You know, the guys at the factory have better benefits and they're making a lot more money per hour, mm-hmm. you know? But in hindsight, I'm glad I stuck it out because it eventually paid off.
Yeah.
You know? I even left the dealership at one point to work at a GMC dealer in the next town just because I was so frustrated. I couldn't get a raise.
Yeah.
And I left and worked for 2 days and I hated the traveling, you know, because I remember, you know, in Colebrook, if you're going to work at the dealer, there was only 2 dealers, the Ford dealership and the Chevrolet dealership. So if you were going to work another dealer, you had to leave the area. And they kind of knew that, I think, you know.
Right.
And I got hired another dealer. So I told him, you know, I was making $10 an hour. I won 15. Guy mm-hmm. said, okay. Didn't even hesitate.
Right.
You know? And I worked 2 days at this other dealer and I was already sick of the traveling.
Yeah.
So I went back to the owner. I said, look, if you're willing to give me what I want, I'll come back. And they took me back and said, okay. You know, mm-hmm. I had to, but it kind of pissed me off that I had to actually leave the dealer that I've been with for so many years just to get paid what I thought I should be paid.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Yeah. And you probably heard the line, like that's the line that always pissed me off. You'd say, well, you need to produce more hours then. Right. Or you're just like over that guy over there, he's killing it. Right. Like he had 60 last week, you know, whatever the number would be. Right. Yeah. And I'm like, he's literally done like 10 sets of struts, you know,
yeah.
10 brake jobs, 10 sets of tires. Like he did a valve cover gasket and a tune up. You know what I mean? Like he's just over there, the low hanging fruit. I've got this car with a can problem. I've got this car with a, you know, you drive it for, you know, 10 minutes and the transmission goes into limp. Like I've got this one that's towed in that, you know, came from another shop because they can't figure it out. Like that's what I'm doing. And I'm killing myself. I'm here 6 days a week to hit 45.
Yeah.
Like, and you're telling me he's over there hitting 60 and it's because I'm not working hard enough. There's levels to this, man. Right. Like that's the part that at the dealer always cranked me is it's just like, they never wanted to look at people. I see now, I think that it's like, as you get your certs, you get more per hour, but we've had that conversation where some guys are like, well, the more certs I get, the less money I make because the harder work that I get. When I was there, it didn't matter your certs. You just, if you were a licensed technician, you got paid X. And then it was all about how many hours you produced. And, the only thing that changed for me was the fact that when we were doing retail Diag, my service manager way back then had the foresight to be like, well, we're not hardly selling parts when we're doing Diag. So he put the labor rate up on Diag work and it paid me an hour and a half for every hour I was on it.
Kind of a simple solution, wasn't it?
It seemed so at the time because it was like, they'd go, well, and I'd be like, it'd be check engine light. It was a smoke test for an EVAP leak. I get paid Diag. A time and a half. Now, did I need to hook the smoke machine to every one of them? Nope. I knew right where to look. I knew, you know, but hey, it's still Diag. The other guys would be all day and not find it. Yeah. And I knew right where to go. I knew how to break the system down, like how to test it. I could tell if, you know, you could have smoked it forever and it's skewed data. It's not, you know, a leak. They didn't know how to test it, tell the difference.
Yeah.
That's why I was worth more. And that was the only thing that kept me excuse me, to where I didn't lose my cool most of the time because it's like he had 60, but our paychecks were just about the same because I had like some weeks I'd have 15 hours of Diag, which is, you know, time and a half, like on top of whatever ounce I sold. So that was, I'm glad to see some of the dealer techs that I talked to. It seems like some of them, the owners are finally starting to grasp the reality that there's a major technician shortage, and you know, their people are not staying. You know, how many years do you think you got left, Chris?
Well, one thing I would say, I don't want to be turning wrenches. I'd like to be done turning wrenches. Like, I'm 53 now. Yeah. I don't see myself turning wrenches on cars at 60.
Right.
Not because I don't think physically I can do it. That's one thing I will tell. One thing that has served me well, and I would tell younger technicians, is take care of your body.
Yeah.
And so what I've done the last, I'm going to say probably the last 25 years, is when everybody goes to lunch, I go to the gym. Mm-hmm. And I pump iron for a good 50 minutes.
Right.
And so I try to keep myself in shape, and I think it's helped. And it's not just so, you know, I want to be able to get underneath dashes and do work and not have a sore back the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And of course they pick on me too, because a lot of Fridays during the summer, they'll be barbecuing and say, "Well, Chris, we know it's a waste of our time, but we're making burgers at lunchtime. No, you won't show up, but just so you know," yeah. I'll say, "Yeah." And I just laugh, but I'm committed to going to the gym on my lunch hour and working out. And that's served awesome. Me well, you know, yeah. through the years.
That's fantastic.
But the only reason I tell you I don't want to be turning wrenches on cars at 60 is I want to be a marine mechanic. I do a lot of boat work here at the lake for my neighbors and stuff. And to me, my older years, the road test on the water is a lot better than doing road test on cars.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. if you look at the marine, and you own a boat, so you know the technology yeah. on marine equipment is at least 10 to 15 years behind automotive, you know?
Yeah.
So it's easier. It's you know?
Simple.
Yeah. yeah.
The only thing that scares me about marine mechanics is when I look at how they jam some of those inboards in some of those bigger boats. And then it's like, I've seen the guys and I've done it, and you crawl up over there and you're upside down, like trying to do something. And I'm just like, no, I'd get a chainsaw and cut that sucker in pieces and there'd be scrap.
That's when you pull the engine out.
Yeah.
I've had the inboards out, and you get a good, you know, engine lift. You can have that engine out in less than an hour.
Yeah.
You know, and if you get to charge a customer to do that, so be it. Mm-hmm. I'm like you. Some of those inboards are hard. Like, to even like to change a starter.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you're crawling on your head to get at it, you know? Yeah. And that's my exit out is I'd like to be doing marine work. Mm-hmm. And hopefully I'm in that position to do that. I may have to like leave the area, maybe either sell my house or rent it out to go to an area where it's, you know, it's more, you know, an area to be able to do that.
Well, I was going to say it's seasonal too, up where you are.
Yeah.
Up where I am, it's seasonal, right? So yeah, like a lot of guys up here, they work on maybe snow machines, you know, or quads or snow blowers or something like that. Right. And then they kind of go into the marine thing. At the side, there was a really successful guy around here. And that was, you know, from as soon as the boats were being taken out of storage and put in the lake, he was busy. Right. Yeah. Until I'm talking like yachts and then big inboards and cruisers and all that kind of stuff. And then the wintertime would just kill him, you know, so he would hopefully like somebody would bring him some outboards that he could, you know, put back together during the wintertime, right? Source parts for some of the older stuff.
Yeah.
But it's always the same thing. Everybody leaves it to the last end. It's always a running joke up here. I have a friend that does marine and bass fishing always starts like the last weekend, pretty much of June. And nobody calls him, Mark is his name. Nobody calls Mark in February and says, "Hey, can you get my boat tuned up now?" Right. Everybody is waiting until May to start calling Mark, and they call Mark and go, "Mark, you know, opening weekend's in 3 weeks and I just went out and put batteries in a boat and it won't start. Can you look at it?" And he's like, "I can look at it in about October." You know, like, he's so busy now fitting like, fish finders and trolling motors and upgrading the wiring in the boats so that they can handle, you know, if you want to go from a 24 volt system to a 36 volt for your trolling motor, he does all that.
Yeah.
He's so busy now. It's just like people, and that's the kind of work he likes, is because it's like, you know, people pay good money to have the sonar systems fitted And he's a fantastic fisherman himself. So he actually knows when they're really working, what it's supposed to look like. So he can not only install it and wire it, he can dial it in for you, teach you how to use it. You know, it's that's been his, because he started as a mechanic just like us, and then dabbled in some, like he worked on some gen sets and stuff like that, and now that's pretty much his main gig, is just fixing boats for people. And that's, he loves it. He built himself a little shop right on his property. He picks and chooses his clientele. They pay him very well. But I mean, like, he's also, like, he's redone transoms in the back of some of the older boats. People get weird about boats, eh? Like, you'll see, like, some, you know, 1985 Ranger bass boat, you know, the original old 150 on it or something like that, Black Max, and it's like, yeah, it, like, and they'll fix it, you know, and the transom will be starting to go, and they'll fix it, and he's like, this is a serious job. Like, this is complete, you know, tear the fiberglass right off, go down, do the runners, the whole thing. Yep. They pay him.
Yeah. Well, you look at the prices of some of these outboards.
Yeah.
And it's unbelievable. And what I've realized on, especially on the two strokes, I don't know so much on the four strokes, but on the two strokes, the parts are really cheap for them.
Yeah.
And if you're going to go out and buy an engine in to replace that two stroke, it's big money.
Yeah.
But like I, for example, the last boat I had, it had just had a simple Yamaha 2-cylinder, 50 horsepower. It was low on compression.
Yeah.
You know, I bought new rings for that and the gaskets. And, you know, I think the parts were a little over $200 by the time I was done. Because I had a part, I put a, you know, a thermostat in it. You know, I bored out the cylinders. First one I did, and my compression went from, I think it was 80 PSI to 130.
Oof.
And, you know, that was an easy repair.
Yeah.
Now, I spent, you know, I don't know how much time I had to it, because I had it in my cellar during the winter. I took the engine right off the boat, put it in my cellar. I don't know how much time, but, you know, I was probably listening to a podcast, sipping a beer while I was working on it. It was not stressful at all.
Yeah.
Probably had a little over $200 into it. Now, you think how much I would have had to spend to replace that motor.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's people need, and like around here, people, you'll come see me, my neighbors, because I'm friends with all my neighbors. They all have different types of boats. You know, one has a jet boat, one has a pontoon boat. So, you know, they'll ask me before going to the dealership, because up here in the middle of summer, if you're going to take your boat to the dealer, you're done boating.
Yeah.
Because they're not going to get to it until the end of the year.
Yeah. After Labor Day, before they'll even look at it.
Right. Yeah.
You just, yeah, I get it. I mean, they're it's the same thing. They're now focusing on the stuff that breaks, you know, not on maintenance or anything else. They've got enough of, like, you know, he tells me props are a wonderful thing. You know, props are, as soon as everybody goes to a stainless steel prop to pick up like another mile per hour and top speed, I sell a whole lot more lower units that way.
Because
when you hit on a stainless on a stump, it don't flex, you know, that lower unit took the thing, whereas I still run an old, like, you know, aluminum. So I mean, if I hit a stump, I break the blade right off the thing.
Yeah.
But I carry a spare one with me, and I don't hurt my lower unit. Like, I just break the prop, right? And it's like, but guys are like, oh, it goes so much faster with, you know, stainless steel. It goes about 5 miles more an hour top speed faster. I'm gonna still catch the fish.
Yeah, it's not worth it to switch to stainless steel.
No, you know? it's for me. And then guys play with it so much. Like, it's like, how does the hole shot and everything? It's all fascinating stuff. But I mean, when it's like, Mark is the only guy I know that has a selection of props that he's bought. So he actually dials in. It's just like, it's all like dyno tuning, right? He goes out, puts a prop on the boat, runs the boat with this load, with a tournament load, with a fuel full tank, with a half tank. And then says to the people, I've tried 8 different props on it. This is what you get a better hole shot this way, but you get a better top speed this way. What do you want to run? And then he doesn't say, you know, my prop is going to do exactly what on your boat, what it does on mine. But I can tell you that I've tried everything from this size to this size on this same size outboard. This is what it did to my boat. It might not do the same to your boat because the hull plays such a factor. Like, it's, I didn't know until I went and fished with him for a couple of days. the fascinating stuff. There's so much more to it. The fastest boat I've ever been into is still his, and it's an older Triton, but he'll tell you, he's a technology guy. So it's like every time Mercury has come out with a improved version of their four-stroke 250, he's put it on his boat.
Yeah.
Brand new.
Well, and yeah.
And he's paid good money for it, but it's ridiculously fast.
Oh, yeah.
Like 70 mile an hour plus top speed out of a bass boat. Like it's just stupid. Stupid fast.
Well, it's funny too. In the marine industry now, that they're just coming out with, throttle by wire. Mm-hmm. You know, well, that's been out on Chevys, at least on Chevrolets, 2003, and they're just starting to do that now. Yeah. So to me, even though I'm not, an expert boat technician by any means, the technology is so far behind on it, mm-hmm. that if I have the service information, I can figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, and I've had enough different type of boats I've had to fix my own stern drives. The stern drives are basically just a rear end.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
Working on stern drives, I had a jet boat, and it's, you learn so much. I've had every type of boat up here living on the lake that I just learned a lot just by fixing my own boats. Mm-hmm. So when the neighbors need help, I'm not afraid of it, you know? Yeah.
That's good, man.
Yeah.
That's really, I keep saying my retirement plan is going to be like a few more podcasts, like try to ramp them up. And I want to buy an older RV. I want to put a boat, like a trailer hitch on the back of it. And, you know, wintertime, I'm going to Texas or Florida.
There you go.
And then I'm going to just pull into somebody's shop. We'll set up and I'll record an episode. And, camp in their parking lot for a day or two, watch how they do things at their shop, and then I'll go fish, and then I'll go somewhere else. And then summertime, I'll come back up here when it's a little bit warmer. Yeah. Our smallmouth fishing up here is absolutely amazing. Like, we have people, there's so many people from down south that come here after July to fish smallmouth. It's unreal. It's incredible. And yet, but you know, the mass exodus used to be every spring. People from up here would go to Texas or Florida to fish largemouth. Now those guys are coming up here to fish our smallmouth. Like, it's pretty cool to see, because as our fish have gotten more popular, dialed in, and people have started to see the potential, we've got a lot more tourism coming up here. Now, COVID killed all that, but it's coming back now. So it's cool to see. You know, you meet a lot of people from down south, and they're like, I tell them where I am, and they're like, you're right on the St. Lawrence? Yeah. Oh man, I fished a tournament up there. Like, smallmouth was, yeah, I know. Like, you know, you kind of say, it's like, I got a picture of a 6-pounder. Like, 6-pounder, yeah, you know, I got one of them. Like, we don't, guys barely take a picture of a 6-pounder anymore up here. Like, it's so, you know, have you caught an 8 yet? And they're like, an 8? Yeah, an 8. Like, they're out there. There's so many of the big ones out here. It's just ridiculous. It's, you know, from upstate New York all the way down the river, right into Lake Ontario where I live, it's smallmouth Disneyland is one pro nicknamed it. He just loves it. So great area to live in. So
it sounds like it's probably a lot like here. You know, I mean, I think we got we got Lake Bass, I believe, and Lake Trout, and there's a few other couple other types of fish, I guess, that they find here. And I guess the fish, I know the fishing's good because I have a depth finder on my boat. Mm-hmm. And it also is a fish finder. It's the hummingbird.
Yeah. Yep.
And I'll be out there some days and I just see fish.
Yeah.
You know, both on the American Canadian side, it's just nonstop. Yeah. Nonstop. So I know, and that pretty good size too. Yep. So I know the fishing is good. And this lake here, it's mostly people that fish it are locals.
Yeah.
Because the public launch isn't that great. So unless you know the lake and know where to go in, a lot of outsiders don't come here. So the fishing stays pretty good because it's just mostly locals, and it's not a whole lot of locals out there. You know, they fish in the morning and you don't see them in the afternoon.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
So.
Yeah. Those lakes that are hard to get to that have crappy launches are the best fishing. Because those are the ones that keep the guys with a big power boat off of it. And I go in there with my smaller boat, or I'll even drop somebody's power boat in, because if you know it, and you're willing to do it, it's they're gems. They're awesome because the fish are untouched. Oh, we call them stupid fish because, like, you know, you could take a bait that was really popular 3 years ago and now all the fish have seen it, and you can go onto that lake and you can throw it around and they've never seen it before. And it's just like, it'll wear your arm out catching them. But yeah, it's, I'm pretty blessed. I won't keep you any longer. I wanted to thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. You had a good time.
I had a great time. Are you familiar with Eric O?
Yeah.
South Bay. Yeah. You think you might do a podcast with him, or?
I have not reached out to Eric, honestly. Yeah. I met Ivan from Pine Hollow at ASTE last year. Yeah. And we talked real quickly. He's like Paul Danner, right? Like everybody wants to talk to Ivan.
Really smart kid.
Oh
yeah.
Yeah. You got to remember he's got an engineering degree from like MIT, right? So, I mean, it's just like, he probably could have been working for NASA and just decided he'd fix cars instead. Like, he is super bright. I'd like to have Eric on. Yeah. I'm not sure how Eric and I've never met him. I've never spoke to him. I don't know. How do I say that? I'm not sure we line up completely on the ideas of the business.
Yeah.
That's what I don't mean any disrespect to him. I just think that, and I'm not saying he does anything wrong. That's not what I'm trying to say. I just, like, his business works for him. I'm not sure if his business model would work for somebody that wasn't as absolutely brilliant in problem solving as he is.
Yeah.
That's the best way I can put it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I can understand that.
So, you know, it's no disrespect. I don't know. I've never talked to the guy. I have a same as like every post on the YouTube channel. Somebody keeps saying, you got to interview Keith DeFazio. Got to interview Keith DeFazio. Like, I'm not lacking for people that want to be on the podcast. You know what I mean? Obviously, right? Like, you contact me like, hey, I got some stories I want to tell. Yeah. So it's a situation of, I have more guests than I can right now. Trying to fit it all together to coordinate it, to get them all recorded is like a job in itself. So that's the beauty of this job that I got now, is because Fridays are tend to be, you know, podcast days, get episodes recorded, get planning for next week, the whole thing. Because when I go to work at 7 a.m, I come home at 7 p.m. I don't stay awake long enough to record anything. Right. You know, it's too, the days are too long. So
I guess I would say with Eric, it'd be a different dynamic because he's only worked for his father and himself.
Yeah.
So it's just a different perspective. You know, he's not worked for an independent or a dealership. But, you know, he seems like a really good guy from what I've seen, a good tech and just a different perspective, you know.
Brilliant tech. And and like, I would love, because I see, like, the one question obviously everyone would want to ask him is like, when you see all the cars that come into your shop that somebody else couldn't fix, does it really make you angry? Because I get the feeling like sometimes he almost lets it slip. You can tell. Like, he's very frustrated. Yeah. So I would love to then hear, if you see the problem, right? Yeah. And you know that it's rampant. Well, what do we do to fix that? And then I don't, you know, because everybody will say, well, techs need to train more. Yep.
Yep.
But training's expensive. And it's costly, right? Costly and expensive, two different things. Expensive is like, it's expensive, but costly means you got to pay the guys to do it.
Yeah.
And then the unfortunate reality is every tech out there isn't necessarily going to be an Eric O or an Ivan or a Paul Danner or yourself or, you know, a Brendan Steckler or any of these guys that are problem solving. So then we get into the whole caveat of like, should there be shops then that shouldn't be allowed to scan a car?
Yeah.
You know, and that's a whole other topic for a whole other day, but it's something to think about, because it's like, you can train till the cows come home. Sometimes you just can't implement the processes in your business that make it lucrative and profitable. And I want to say, when I've seen Eric, I've seen some jobs that I wonder, like, if he did it just based on ego and pride to be able to say, I did it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And whether it was actually that lucrative to bother doing. I don't mean any disrespect if he's listening.
Yeah.
I don't mean any disrespect at all. I would just love to know that. Because at the end of the day, There's nothing wrong with doing that.
No.
But we can't necessarily sell that to everybody else in the industry then as the way that it should be done.
Right.
You know, well, the way it should be done in a perfect world is the customer doesn't pay for misdiagnosis. They don't pay for parts they didn't need. But we all know that sometimes that happens. And it's a big problem to try and solve. And I don't know what the solution is. I'd love to have more people that have a platform. You know, I'd love to have their input because we know what Paul stands on it. But Paul has put it right out there, right? He's jumped right on this topic and tackled it and said, no, you know, if I make the wrong call, you're not paying.
Yeah.
And, you know, unfortunately, I think most of us aren't there where we can say that, you know. And what is wrong is, like, I was watching one of his videos the other day, and it was a Chevy truck that had both, like, a weak fuel pump, a dirty mass airflow sensor, and some injectors that were bad. It was like a 2005 or something with a 6-liter. Like, you get those trucks and you get those vehicles in once in a while, and it does not matter what you do. You're always going to come out on that losing, because if you only change the one thing, the light still comes back on or the other symptom's still there and the customer says you're ripped off. Or if you go and say, hey, you've got three completely different things wrong. Here's all the documentation in the world that shows you got a fuel pump. Here's a fuel pump waveform that shows it's crap. Here's some injector, you know, flow tests that shows they're junk. And here's your math reading. You try and sell all three of those to the customer and they go, you look like you're trying to rip them off. You don't even look like you're incompetent because you got all this data.
Yeah.
But you still maybe look like you're not trustworthy. And
you know, where that happens sometimes, Jeff, is you ever get these customers that say, well, I've put 100,000 miles on my car and I haven't had to do nothing to it. Well, there you go. You get a bunch of one main problem, and then you get like three or four underlying problems. They have worn spark plugs,
yeah,
dirty mass airflow sensor, and they get a vacuum leak.
Yeah.
And you're trying to diagnose a lean code and you got more than one issue going on at the same time. Sure.
Definitely.
And you got 1 hour to diagnose it. Okay. Fix it. Why isn't it fixed? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't want to keep it going, but I'll tell you a perfect example of this is this. I bought a car I've always wanted. Years ago, I bought a Porsche Boxster, a 97.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 weeks after I bought it, the check engine light came on and it was setting a lean code on one bank.
Yeah.
And I tell you what, I spent probably 9 months trying to figure out the problem. You know what the main problem was? Was I clear out the code and then see if it reset. You know, I tried checking the vacuum leaks because it's a mid-engine car. Yeah. So to get to the vacuum hoses, you know, it's an ordeal in itself, you know. Yeah. And I changed a bunch of vacuum hoses that I thought looked kind of iffy or whatever. Smoke tested it, could not find any leaks. And I would drive it. It said, lean code for bank two, you know. And it would run fine for the most part, but it would run lean enough where it would set the check engine light. And I just went through I couldn't find it. And then luckily one day I went to a concert in Connecticut. It was like 6 hours one way. Mm-hmm. It was a hot day. And I went to start it and it wouldn't start. And I had to step on the gas and it was running rich. And then I looked and I happened to have the scan tool with me and it had a rich code. Well, how can it run lean and run rich?
Yep.
The main problem I made was I kept clearing the code too quick. I was chasing a lean code for one bank. But if you let it run long enough, it would set a code for both banks.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're chasing a lean code, it's a totally different situation if you're trying to, you know, chase a lean code for one bank instead of two.
Yep.
And what it was, you know, and what it ended up being was the EVAP purge valve was sticking.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it would stick open, sometimes it stick closed.
Yeah.
Very intermittent.
Yeah.
And I remember when I bought that car, it was on the lot for almost 2 years. No one would buy it. And I knew in the back of my head it was probably a problem car that someone couldn't fix.
Yep.
I feel like it had been at other places trying to fix it and they couldn't fix it because it wouldn't act up long enough.
Yep.
Took me 9 months to figure it out, but I figured it out. But you run into situations like that all the time. And people that are counting, you know, bean counters that looking at the stats, you know, well, he only made 15, 20 hours. They don't see that crap that you run into. No. Okay. No. And being a GM tech, I'm by no means, you know, expert, you know, Porsche tech. Mm-hmm. I had, you know, but I taught myself as much as I could. But, you know, if you're chasing down a lean code, I'm sure you've run into this with even Jeep. You know, if you have something that doesn't show itself all the time, it can be a nightmare to chase down.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
intermittents are the worst. And that's the thing. It goes back to, right? Like, you got to be able to interpret data because, you know, the code just gives you an idea about what you're facing. The data, you got to be able to interpret it. But if you can't interpret it and it's not acting up, it ain't broke. And people drives people nuts when you say that. But it's the truth. It really is. It's not broke right then. So what, you know, I'm going to abandon the process and you tell me, because you're the one with the money, what do you want me to try first? Yeah. And you know, sometimes we try and we have to try. I've had it more than once. My boss has handed me a part and said, here, I scanned this in the parking lot the other day. You know, it's not happening right now. It's intermittent, but I've already pitched the customer on this that we're going to put that in. And I don't see that car come back, so I don't know whether it fixed it or not. I don't even care.
Yeah.
You know, I'm doing what I'm instructed to do. When you mention the 100,000 kilometer thing and somebody says to me, well, I've got 100,000 kilometers and never had to do anything this, my rhetorical answer back to them is congratulations. You did exactly what the OEs expected. It worked perfectly for you. This is when they now want you to trade it. Yeah. So would you like to trade it or would you like to fix it? It's as simple as that. I keep it very simple, you know, and I'm not even selling, but it's the same conversation. The car is not going to require less repairs as it gets on in mileage and age. It's going to require more. So if you're not invested in that, let's, you know, collect my diag for inspecting this thing today and have a nice day and good luck with your purchase.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to accept that this thing is going to start to wear and require more love, let's have a great relationship moving forward and let's get on the process together. So, you know, and you know, they don't like to hear it always that way, but I mean, that's an embellished polite way of sometimes how I've had the conversations in the past, but it's what has to happen. Right.
Right. I mean, people, they don't worry, you know, the problem is when a vehicle's under warranty, they don't worry too much about the maintenance because they figure it'll be covered.
It's covered.
But these manufacturers know how much these systems will last. They know they'll make it out of warranty for most part.
Definitely. You know?
So if a customer doesn't want to do the maintenance when the vehicle's fairly new, they're certainly not going to want to spend the money when it's out of warranty.
No.
You know? And
they don't care no matter what they say about the second owner of the car. They only care about the first owner.
Yeah.
Right. And that's, you know, they'll tell you that, no, because if you're a GM, it doesn't matter. If you're a GM driver, you're a GM customer. Nope, I don't swallow that nonsense for a minute. Because you might have just bought that based on you like the color of it. You don't know jack about GM. And you bought it, and that's cool. But they're so focused on selling that new car to somebody that they're not too focused about how it is for you to fix it after the fact. If it doesn't cost them anything, it doesn't cost them anything. If it wasn't recalled, if it wasn't extended warrantied out, if it wasn't under the base warranty, they don't give a crap.
Yeah.
They're just focused on selling the new one, and good on them. That's what their job is. So anyway, I appreciate you. We'll have you on again.
Yeah, that'd be great.
All right, man.
Yeah. I got more stories next time.
Hey, if you could do me a favor real quick, and like, comment on, and share this episode, I'd really appreciate it. And please, most importantly, set the podcast to automatically download every Tuesday morning. As always, I'd like to thank our amazing guests for their perspectives and expertise, and I hope that you'll please join us again next week on this journey of change. Thank you to my partners in the ASOG Group and to the Changing the Industry podcast. Remember what I always say, in this industry, you get what you pay for. Here's hoping everyone finds their missing 10 millimeter, and we'll see you all again next time.